And welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Veronica Clark, a very interesting conversation here about the National Socialists, about their policies, about what really was occurring. And of course, there's a lot of points to discuss and bring up in these kinds of, when we address these kinds of topics. There's just, it's going to be impossible for us to cover all of them. So, you know, maybe another time we can pick up and do more of them. But some of these major points, of course, I think is important to address in terms of what's flying around out there. And it's great to you know, have someone like you with us, Veronica, who can kind of deconstruct some of this and who have a lot of background information, who can see it in a kind of a different way than what we've been told about this. Let's address the fluoride issue now. This is one that always comes up. I've heard him so many times. I've actually heard one person from the anti-fluoride, group, if you can call it that, that actually urged not to address this because in his view he thought it delegitimized, you know, their kind of their cause or whatnot. But sodium fluoride, they used it in the camps to dumb down people. What's up with that?
Okay, well, if that was the intent of fluoride, it didn't work, because there was not only a communist underground operating within the camps, which Mark Weber has written about extensively, and those essays are on the IHR site still. But, you know, you had uprisings and resistance in the ghettos and the camps under German occupation. So why didn't it work? It didn't dumb down anybody. And then the other thing is, when you actually look at the evidence these people offer, it's some letter to some newspaper, like an obsolete Catholic newspaper that was written by such and such chemist. So it's all coming to us secondhand sources. And ultimately, what you end up finding is that it's this Kreminov, a Soviet, who's being indicted for spreading fluoride to, I guess, the Western democracies after the fact. So you come away from it not knowing whether these people are trying to indict the Nazis or the Soviets for this. And basically, A. True Ott got the myth about Nazi fluoride from Perkins. So let's see, I believe his name is Charles Perkins. Yep, Charles E. Perkins. And Perkins claims to have heard about this myth. He does not say how or when, from an unnamed official who worked for IG Farben. So there is absolutely no way we can confirm whether this is true, because we don't know who the source was at IG Farben. So it's basically secondary evidence coming to us from unnamed sources that nobody can trace. And I actually looked in the book that they attribute this to, which is, first of all, there's Crime and Punishment of IG Farben, written by Joseph Borkin. It's nowhere in there. I didn't find any evidence whatsoever that IG Farben had anything to do with fluoridation under the Nazis. And then the other one was, what is the name of that one book? I don't know if I'm going to be able to find it right off the bat in here. Okay, we won't worry about that. What I'll do is I'll go ahead and read the letter by Charles Perkins. He says, "I was told of this entire scheme by a German chemist who was an official of the great IG Farben chemical industries and was also prominent in the Nazi movement at the time." So what was this man's name? We're not told that. And he was a prominent Nazi. Well, that would have been quite easy to name him and indict him. And of course, I looked through the entire book, The Crime and Punishment of IG Farben, and I did not see one reference to fluoride in that whole book. And there's nothing in the IMT testimonials either, the International Military Tribunal.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I mean, obviously, it doesn't mean that it's good to add fluoride to water, but nonetheless, I wonder why this one got picked up and got so, popular. I guess it's another attempt maybe to kind of delegitimize, since the Nazis are so delegitimate anyway, right? Whatever they touched, that was no good, right? So they try to kind of, you know, piggyback on this issue to get it demonized, perhaps. But of course, that's something that's not going to serve them in the end if people indeed are interested in truth and try to figure out what was happened, because then these kinds of lies will be exposed. But why do you think this one was picked up? Why has that one become so popular, do you think?
You know, I'm not sure. I guess because the people in the whole anti-fluoride movement, they need some kind of ultimate evil to rely on to show that fluoride is ultimate evil, and only ultimately evil people would dare put fluoride in our water supply. And of course, the best place to go is the Nazis. And somehow, for whatever reason, the Catholic Mirror, which is an obsolete paper, I don't know if anyone can even locate the original copy that this article was featured in, but that article basically says that the Nazis fluoridated water. And I mean, it's complete nonsense because it didn't sterilize anyone, and that was apparently supposed to be the purpose, was to dumb down and make them, you know, not want to resist. And then number two, to sterilize the people. Well, how come Philip Mueller mentioned overcrowding in the Auschwitz quote unquote death camp as a result of all the new births there?
Really?
This is in Philip Mueller's Eyewitness Auschwitz, 3 years in the gas chambers. So how come they had so many new births if they were sterilizing everybody with fluoride? And there's just other issues, like, for example, Kremenov. He brought the idea of fluoridation. Says who? I mean, do we even have any evidence that this Kremenov did anything? I can't find anything on that either. It always goes to some online source that doesn't have a basis in any real testimony.
Yeah. Well, that's the perk of trying to find these sources and get to the root of things and get to the bottom of it. But yeah, very interesting how that's caught on for some reason in that regard. But let me ask you a little bit about Poland here as well, if we change topic a bit here, and the aggression, you know, I guess in my view, I've said between Germany and Poland to try to deconstruct what actually happened here with, of course, Prussia, the German corridor. And basically, this is something that kind of led to the lead up of the entire war, really, where it was an issue of disagreements here over territory and whatnot. And I've heard on both accounts that, you know, one attacked the other. How did you go about trying to deconstruct this particular event and what actually happened here that really ultimately, you know, led to the breakout of the war?
Okay, well, I mean, the Poles and the Germans did have like a non-aggression agreement prior to the outbreak of war in 39. And there were negotiations going on between those two countries. And Germany was actually very friendly towards Poland. They even had like a Celebrate Polish Culture Day. And Hitler mourned the death of Józef Piłsudski, who was the leader, the premier of Poland prior to the rise of the liberal democratic, basically communist or Western allied tools that came in after the fact. So what happened to those negotiations? What happened to that relationship to break it down? Obviously, something changed on one side or the other. Now, the Germans stayed consistent because Poland knew and was working to negotiate a deal to give Danzig and the corridor back. And of course, Josef Beck was part of this, and he did not tell the Western democracies what he was doing. So these were like secret negotiations going on just between Poland and Germany. But at the same time, Josef Beck was, you know, the foreign minister over here going, okay, Western allies, are you going to back us or not? Like, just in case war breaks out, do we have a guarantee? So he was trying to play both sides. Let me see what I can get out of Hitler, what kind of concession. So let me just make sure these two countries, Britain, are going to back me in case I decide to not cooperate.
Right.
So there were shenanigans on the Polish side for sure. Now, does this justify Hitler going into Poland, being quite brutal, you know, forcing all these Poles, innocent Polish civilians out of their homes, etc.? Well, that's really a matter of opinion, because the lands that Hitler wanted were ancestrally German. They were formerly German. They were taken away under the Versailles Treaty. And Poland, of course, had no problem confiscating that land and booting Germans out when it, you know, benefited them at Versailles. But then when it comes reeling back on them, they want to scream and wail about their suffering, etc. So in my view, both sides have legitimate grievances, but also legitimate claims. Poland was a victor. So just like Hitler was a victor, and, you know, I'm going to take Danzig in the corridor now and do whatever I want with Poland, which is force all of you out of your homes and put you into the unannexed general government portion of Poland. Poland felt the same way. Well, because we're on the victor side of Versailles, and we're, you know, a state going to be reconstituted, we're going to go ahead and take pieces of Germany. Why not? We're victors. So both countries were imperialist and both countries were victimized. I would say they're about even on their suffering and imperialism. Hmm. But what is kind of interesting is Joseph Beck, during the Munich crisis, he initiated bilateral talks with Germany to settle the problem of Danzig and the corridor. And after Germany let him have the Teschen area of Czechoslovakia, he then refused to make concessions. So Poland was perfectly okay going, oh yes, we'll take that little piece of Czechoslovakia and be imperialist. But then when there was more in addition to that, and this is similar to what Stalin, the game he played under the Nazi-Soviet pact, well, we don't want to give any further concessions, and we're just going to go ahead and not honor that other stuff. So this, of course, bent Hitler the wrong way. You don't mess with him, because he will come down with a hammer on you, as we know. So, you know, I would say that Germany was justified to take back Danzig and the corridor, and they did not, in fact, annex all of Poland. So that is a lie. Poland was not fully occupied. The general government was simply governed by Germany. It was never annexed. So that was going to be basically a quote unquote rump Polish state. So, but as far as the discrimination and the persecution of the civilians, I would say that was largely unjustified. Now, if certain civilians had hacked up and bludgeoned German civilians who were living in that area, which that did happen. We know right. about, you know, the Bloody Sunday, etc. And there were incidents leading up to that, the war as well, that Germans were being persecuted, discriminated against, economically pressured and beaten and killed. But just because one side does it doesn't mean you take a bunch of innocent civilians and do the same thing to them. So I would say a lot of the persecution and discrimination probably should have been avoided.
Do we see any mimics of this in modern times? Because, I mean, the we have incursions into other, you know, countries, and they're all the time occurring now in these days with America and the military and everything else. I mean, just look at, you know, Libya, for example, and it's kind of, in many cases, also the proof for it is questionable. In some cases, they present very scarce information about what actually has happened, or that, oh, the, you know, the leadership is turning on its own people. We have to go in there. We have to do this. This seems like a kind of a classic MO, really, in terms of how they're trying to justify incursions into other countries. And it becomes very difficult to know what's really going on. I guess in this case, you have to be able to defend your people. I mean, whatever happens, happens. There isn't like a rule or a law here really that can protect this from ever happening. This is just how it is, right? And if there are, you know, complaints in terms of how the country has been going back and forth into different hands, it's just something that is. My point, I guess, is that it's kind of part of human nature of fighting over territory and resources, and have disagreements and disputes. I guess the difference is in the First and Second World War is that we have a completely different technological mechanism at our disposal, and it turns into these massive, you know, slaughtering fests, basically, due to the technology that we have available. So it's almost like that's what we're grappling with more than it comes to disagreements and human disputes. Would you agree?
I would agree. Certainly, technological warfare and just all the weapons that came into play in World War II, especially. I mean, these things were just devastating. So, yeah, I mean, it just adds a whole new factor. Now, it is similar today in wars of yesterday that we're going to fight for citizens, et cetera. And I think that has to be brought into account. I guess people need to sit back and ask themselves, is it worth it to take your entire nation to war like Hitler did over a minority of your people living in another country being persecuted and discriminated and massacred? Now, the massacres were obviously isolated incidents. You know, not all Germans were being massacred in Poland. But that's really the question we need to ask. Is that worth going to war over? Hitler tried, I think, to the best of his ability to avoid an actual land war. And he did offer reparations payments and to cease further hostilities if Poland would come to the table, if the Western democracies would come to the table and work out a solution for Poland and Germany both, and they refused. So, you know, it's really a matter, again, of opinion. What is worth fighting for? Hitler and the NS elites believed that it was worth going to war for.
Yeah. Well, the exaggeration here, of course, as well as, you know, Lebensraum, right? We need living space, and people from that point of view kind of look at this as, all right, the Nazis wanted to basically, you know, take over all of Europe, and eventually they wanted to take over all the world. They wanted to, I hear that all the time on these random, you know, watching a documentary or even, you know, other types of settings, that this was one of their motives of actually trying to dominate the world, like they were behind some kind of new world order. But that isn't correct, is it?
No, I mean, the only reason Hitler invaded the northern countries, etc., was basically as Britain started landing and the Allies got more and more involved, it necessitated further occupations, further encroachments on other sovereign territories. So that was all necessitated by the developing military situation. It was not planned out. That was really put together ad hoc. Okay, now we need to go to Norway. Now we need to go to, you know, maybe even do some stuff in Switzerland, and we need to go to Denmark, and all this stuff started happening. So as far as the living space, that factor did not come in until much later as the war developed. And as Hitler and the elite said, you know, I think we're going to defeat the Soviet Union. They're reeling. And so they kind of figured, okay, well, this would answer our Jewish problem, which would be wonderful. Instead of putting them in Madagascar, which everyone is resisting, the whole world resisted the Madagascar plan and any kind of plan to put the Jews elsewhere, we can put them in Russia as this territory opens up to us. And then we can just push the Slavs back a little bit further east and have all this area for our future empire. And we'll put Germans here, we'll put Dutchmen here, you know, we'll let all different Germans, Germanics, if you will, they considered all these people Germanics. We'll let them all come in and grab some land and start developing it. And of course, the Slavs were going to be kind of a second-class citizen in the scheme of things. Though, like every empire, they would have resisted that. There would have been those soft-hearted Nazis that went, you know, these Slavs, they really do want to go to university, Hitler. Can we just, you know, start educating them? That's just ultimately what happens. You know, people get soft-hearted about it. They become humanitarian as empire develops. And I have no doubt at all that the same thing would have happened with Nazi Germany had it actually had its empire. And you would have seen Germans marrying Slavs too. It was already happening, and they were already having basically illegitimate children all over in Eastern Europe, etc., against the Nazis' quote-unquote racial will. So as far as Lebensraum, that was only the ancestral portions that were previously German.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was the Lebensraum he was talking about. He wasn't talking about taking all of Russia. And this idea that there was a mass extermination plan against Slavs is a lie. That rests all on one individual. I believe it was von dem Bach Zalewski. He sold out at the IMT, and the whole entire Ostplan rests on his testimony alone.
Interesting. Now, I know there's another, I think it was called the Jewish Autonomous Oblast, right? That was far east in Russia. Was that part of this plan as well? Is that what they tried to do here?
Are you talking about the Birbijan?
Let's see. I'm looking here. To the far right, it's close to China, basically.
Okay, I think that was the same location. It's Birobidzhan or something like that. I'm not totally sure how to pronounce it. But yeah, it was a Jewish, basically, state within the Soviet state. And as a matter of fact, Stalin was trying to get Jews to go there. And he would force them out. He's like, I need Jews out of the city. They're causing trouble. They're bilking people. They're engaging in all these activities that are not good for the Soviet people. And, you know, I've got an irate population here. I want you going to this nice little settlement that I set aside for you and made quite nice. And they would go right back out of that settlement and go right back into the cities. So even Stalin himself was trying to solve his Jewish problem. And he had written a letter to Roosevelt about Zionism. And how he was a Zionist. And yeah, I want these people out of here. and in their own state, if you will. I'm sure that was the same spot.
Yeah, Biro Bizdan, or however you pronounce that. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, that's
yes.
The one.
And Hitler even talks about that in the table talk. He goes, "Who's going to complain to me if I park the Jews in the marshy parts of Russia? I don't hear anyone crying for Germans." And here's something interesting. The Nazis and the Poles had both sent experts to Madagascar before that plan fell out, you know, time and time again, because of French resistance, primarily French, including Vichy, who was an ally of Germany. They even resisted. They sent these teams of investigators to make sure it was habitable for the Jews so that they would be okay there and not die of tropical diseases, etc. This is a whole new Hitler we're hearing about here.
Interesting. Yeah, very interesting. I think the autonomous oblast are even adopted. Actually, it was in 96, so this was actually later, but the rainbow flag, kind of going back to the Noahide laws and all that kind of stuff there. But this is, what do you think, if you could just give us a kind of a more broader overview in terms of what the war was about, really, in terms of ideology? I mean, we've talked with other guests about this before as well, that it seems to have been more kind of an issue of the fear of communist expansion, really. That's what this was about. It was about trying to preserve, you know, from Hitler's point of view, European civilization as they saw it, in terms of trying to preserve. They realized that this is going to be a corrosive force on civilization, and they wanted to, at every cost, try to prevent that from happening. Is that a simplified view, do you think, or is there more to it than that?
I used to think it was mostly about communism, but in the light of the Russo-German agreement, or the Nazi-Soviet pact, Hitler was willing to coexist with the Soviet Union and communism if it was possible. And it was a genuine pact, though he wanted to have a backup war plan just in case that fell out. Because, of course, just like Stalin's intelligence said, you know, Germany doesn't really like communism, etc., they may have designs, Hitler's intelligence was saying the same thing. And of course, it was General Halder that kept pointing, "Hitler, excuse me, did you notice these Soviet divisions that are aligning on the border? If you think that's just a training exercise, you're nuts. This means war, and we need to start getting this underway." So there was always the two sides, and Stalin's the same way. This is documented by Konstantin Pleshikov in Stalin's Folly, an excellent book. He details the whole process of the Russian offensive against Europe and Germany. So the two sides were both kind of willing to be aggressive if needs be, but I think they did try to coexist. And I think that for the most part, it was genuine. But as things developed, it was no longer the case. They could only act and react however events played out. So much of it was ad hoc on both sides. And really, Hitler and Stalin preempted one another. And I think more than just communism, it was Pan-Slavdom versus the dying, dwindling Germanic race and people. Hitler, and perhaps Himmler more so, was really concerned with the dwindling Germanic numbers, especially in Europe. They're like, "Look, we don't have population. If this is not reversed, the East is just going to come swallowing Europe just by numbers alone. I mean, demographics is destiny."
Yeah.
So I think it was more an issue of demography than, say, communism versus National Socialism. And as Lawrence Dennis, he was a mulatto intellectual, kind of in that era, and he passed away in the 70s, and he was, of course, the number one person in Willis Carto's life, the individual behind the Barnes Review. Lawrence Dennis said, "Wars are never fought between isms or ideologies. That's just the cuteries put around war. It's always fought between peoples. We must understand this." And so I think he was correct. This was really Germandom versus Slavdom, and what was going to be the future in Europe. And then, of course, Stalin had aggressive designs. He went to war against Finland. He was encroaching more and more on Eastern territory. How is the Reich supposed to respond to that? You know, "Oh, just let him come crawling along."
Well, exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, these are actions in the real world. There are going to be reactions too. It's just how it is. To a certain extent, it's kind of like, is it unavoidable? Is it just something that it just occurs due to the nature of, I mean, I guess we could put human nature in at the bottom of that, or at the top of it rather, as a kind of an issue of why this occurs. And because a lot of people today, of course, they see nationalism as the root of these kinds of evils, right? Even the opportunists after the Second World War reason that, okay, let's avoid this from ever happening again. We have to unite the world, you know, League of Nations pop up and all these objectives to try to unify and globalize the world. And we're obviously seeing the full bloom effects of that, at least in the Western world and Europe in specifics right now. But what's your view there? I mean, is this something that was unavoidable if you had nations, or why not be at peace with each other? Not possible?
It's difficult to say. I mean, right now it seems like everyone's kind of getting along except for the United States basically smashing the Middle East and trying to reorganize it along completely new Albionist Zionist lines. It seems like Europe is at peace, but now we have Russia starting to go, you know, we just don't like we don't like the present world order. We don't like how we've been pushed back. We want to get back into Europe a little bit. And I think that's really what's at the heart of Putin's Ukrainian policy, et cetera. He does not want to see Ukraine and part of Slavdom fall to NATO, to the Anglo-Saxon sphere or the Germanic sphere. So I think there's basically an eruption right below the surface. And yes, it probably is just the human condition, because we have always been at war at one point or another. So it probably was inevitable. Yeah. And I guess we're just going to have to figure out where we go from here. I mean, I don't know where we're headed, but it's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of a side note really, but it's just interesting asking you about this and how you viewed it in particular with this kind of history and context here. But obviously demographics in Europe is changing as well. And I don't think that is going to bode well at all in any regard. I think we're seeing, unfortunately, due to the swift changes in the demographics with mass immigration and everything else, seeing a rise in conditions that are going to be anything but peaceful. So I think we're in for another one of these rides. I think either they know what they're doing, or if they truly are just naive and think that this is going to work out, that they then they're deluding themselves completely, you know?
Exactly. I have no idea I don't understand how the European governments think they're going to somehow make that whole Islamic migration, mass Islamic migration, et cetera, work out in Europe. They're already having problems. There's fissures opening up everywhere. So whether they thought they were going to keep this monster under control, I don't know. Did the Jews want chaos and fissures and the fracturing and disintegration of Europe as it stands? I really don't know. I couldn't pinpoint the elite agenda right now. But I do know that really American power, it's at a crossroads. I think America's going down and going to become a second-rate country, much like the former Soviet Union. It was a slow rot that occurred, and I think the same thing is happening to America. And it's kind of lashing out in one last imperialist adventure before it comes reeling back on itself. And of course, Hitler was very concerned about growing American imperium and power. And so that was another thing that he opposed and he was very leery of. And he's like, don't the British understand that America's going to usurp everything they've built? And sure enough, America inherited Britain's disintegrated empire and power. Even banking transferred really from the city of London to Washington and the Federal Reserve. So it's kind of interesting how that all went down. If anyone controls the world, it's the United States of America and Israel. It isn't Germany.
Yeah.
But I really don't know what the elite's scheme is right now.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, bloated and it's just too much. It's spread out. They can't keep it up, and specifically with the economy as well. It's going to kind of crumble from within, as the tendency seems to be with these empires, and God knows who's going to fulfill that or fill that role, because there's a lot of other, you know, areas and regions and people that want to try to fill that void if and when that occurs, you know, but that's another question, I guess. Let me ask you a little bit more, if we go back here for a moment to England then, and look at the plans to declare war on Germany before they claimed that Germany attacked Poland, etc. Because a while back we had a story up on the website in terms of how the speech for you know, King George was written. I think it was 9 days before they actually you know, claimed that they was going to go into Germany, which is of course a huge giveaway in terms of what they really were thinking about. So how do you view that, and the British role in this as kind of being culprits when it comes to letting this situation completely spiral out of control as it did?
Oh, absolutely. The British always had designs against the Germans. And Wilfried Hank wrote a really, really good essay. It's chapter 15 in the Union Jackal. It's called The Road to Versailles. And I think he also published it on Inconvenient History's blog. But basically, what he details in this essay is that, contrary to any sort of myth that Britain was this innocent little power that kind of just wanted to coexist with Germany and they weren't warmongering, it was quite the opposite. And there were British officials, and it was the official stance of the British government, that it's either England or Germany. It can't be both of us. And we will be the ones that control the world, and Germans will be smashed in that process. And they just say this. It's like open information for these people. I can try to find that quote for you, because it's really quite stunning. And I had never heard of this until I came across it in his essay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In 1895, the upper classes, beginning with Great Britain, formed a war party against Germany, which is still at work today, and which will be documented by citations from the years 1895 to 1994. And of course, this is from Stephen Warner, 100 Years of War Against Germany. So this has been kind of this ongoing battle, perhaps a racio-cultural battle at its root, between the Anglo-Saxons and the Germans. So on February 1st, 1896, an article appeared in the Saturday Review written by a biologist, by Sir P. Chalmers Mitchell, with the caption, "A Biological View of Our Foreign Policy." At the end of this, he says the following: "Were every Brit to be wiped out tomorrow, the Germans would gain in proportion. Here is the first great racial struggle of the future." So we see here, this is a race war.
Yeah.
In this Brit's opinion, "Here are two growing nations pressing against each other, man to man all over the world. One or the other has to go. One or the other will go." I mean, this is astounding.
Wow.
Coming
yeah.
from a British person. And then the biological view of our foreign policy is plain. First, we federate our colonies, thereby preventing their geographical isolation and the turning of the Anglo-Saxon race against itself. So number one, they had to unify everything in the Commonwealth. Second, be ready to fight Germany. Germany must be destroyed. And that's Germania est delenda, or Germania est delenda. Germany must be destroyed.
Yeah.
That was their official policy.
Oh, God. Yeah. Well, I mean, we have so much of that kind of literature coming out as well, you know. The people detailed that in terms of Kaufman, you know, Germany must perish, and, you know, the myth of German villainy. There are a lot of this kind of stuff going around at that point as well. And I don't understand how people haven't seen that's the case. That this is, I mean, specifically with some of the actions towards the end of the war, with some of the attacks on Germany and, you know, Dresden and many of these other places as well, that it was, they took the opportunity to try to murder and kill as many German people as they possibly could and get away with it due to the conditions of the brutality of the war and what has occurred there. It was just such a mess. And I think that they just took that opportunity to do it. And it's not recognized today for what it truly was, which is a genocidal war, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I mean, this was early, like late 1800s, early 1900s, they were saying this. So it's long before Hitler comes along. And of course, they felt the same way against the Kaiser. There just could be no co-ruling of the world. It had to be either the Anglo-Saxons or the Germans. And of course, the Anglo-Saxons won. And again, the numbers the Anglos could put into service was just immense compared to Germany. They just had so many more citizens, so many more members of their quote unquote race. And a really interesting book I would recommend to everyone is Clarence Streit, Union Now, The Proposal for Inter-Democracy Federal Union. This was put out in 1940. He basically lays out the blueprint of the United Nations, and he says that Germany will forever be smashed under this organization, this basically supranational entity of Anglo-Saxon Western democratic states and those who believe in our worldview. It is, for all intents and purposes, the new world order that everyone speaks of. Mm-hmm. And it is spelled out in detail in Union Now with Britain. And then there's another book that preceded that. It was around the time of World War I. Similar intent. Germany was evil. Germany's going to be next door. Oh, we got to worry about Germany. And it was put out by a guy named Sinclair Kennedy. And it's called The Pan Angles. And what he says in that book is that Anglo-Saxons are the greatest race in the whole history of the world, and we deserve to rule the world. And if Germany does not comply, she will be forced to do so. It's an incredible book, and I just happened to come across this.
Wow.
And that's all in the Union Jackal. I have both of those completely detailed and explained in that book.
Yeah. Very good. Well, that's just, yeah, that's amazing that we haven't heard about this. It's, I wonder how much, we understand, of course, this is political strategy. This is ideology. It's a worldview kind of thing, right? But at the same time, I wonder what biological factors potentially even lies at the root of this as a kind of a competition. And I just, you know, I can't help to think today that it's like, what an awful, awful shame to see all these, people. I mean, Angles and Saxons, they used to be in they're a German people. They were, southern Denmark, northern Germany, they're cousins. They're the same, almost. And yet, despite that, there seems to be this amazingly strong agonistic kind of relationship there. I don't think it's there as much anymore because it's been, due to everything that has occurred. But do you believe that there could be any kind of biological background to this, meaning this is something that's more kind of subconscious, is something that just kind of people act on it? They just, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think there's definitely differences genetically, biologically, and their expression in Anglo-Saxons versus even Europeans. So there is a genetic or biological basis to be. Behavior. This is even taught in typical biology classes and psychology classes today. I took some courses in biopsychology at the PhD level, and they were saying that there was indeed a biological basis to behavior. So this idea that race is a completely social construct, or even our worldviews and the way we think is purely sociocultural, is nonsense. And of course, we know that political affiliations, even between like Democrats and Republicans, has a genetic basis. They've proven this in studies. So again, race, the concept thereof is the cultural, the linguistic, the sociological, and the biological together. So when you take those Germans, the Angles and the Saxons, for instance, maybe mix them up with some Celtic, perhaps a little bit of Slavic, whatever race of people were living in the English Isles way back in the day when those Saxons and Angles went over there.
Some Nordic, maybe later, yeah.
Exactly, exactly. What you have is a new race. So now the Anglo-Saxon is no longer the same race as the German. And this is where I think racialists today are misunderstanding why the two are so opposed to one another and why there never is going to be some unified front or some reconciliation. We are fundamentally different races. They're leaving out the cultural, linguistic, sociological aspects that are very important. And again, even Nazi theorists proved this. One among being Eugen Fischer, Dr. Eugen Fischer. He studied the Rehoboth Bastards, which was the Dutch, English, and blacks in South Africa mixed together. They became a new race called the Rehoboth people. And in this study, he realized race is not just genetic. There's other factors there. And so this trickled down into official NS race policy. And I think those are the factors that we're leaving out when we see Britain versus Germany. They really are two different races.
Interesting. Well, I mean, obviously they are trying to homogenize Europe, and maybe on some philosophical level up in the ranks, they had a view that, okay, well, you know, we have to, you know, terminate the Germans and Germany so that we can dominate, you know, in the way we will. And it's been wars for many, many thousands of years between the various, you know, tribes in Europe. That's just how it goes. But what's bizarre, the bizarre outcome of the situation now is, of course, that even the Anglo-Saxons are experiencing replacement level migration in their own countries and whatnot. And I just wonder what the goal here is, and if they took too much over their head, if they realized that they were going to dominate the world, or if even that's what they were trying to do. I mean, within England itself, it's certainly a lot of people, even like Tony Blair, for example, who they were happy to begin this process of changing, you know, the face of Britain, and as a political measure try to take in as many immigrants into the country as possible. I think even said that quite openly, that it was a way to break the spirit of the conservatives in the country. So there's a lot of other factors that is at play today. I can't help just to think of the sadness of these people being going at each other's throat like this, and or, you know, trying to kill each other in this capacity, in this way. And now the very demographic makeup of Europe in itself is threatened. It's horrible to think about this, you know?
Right. And the only explanation I have for the elites being happy about this and explaining in every way they can, you know, the massacres of whites or the mass rape of whites in Britain, et cetera, at the hands of these Muslim immigrants, et cetera, that they're still trying to make this dream happen. It goes back to the Freemason, Coudenhove Kalergi or Kalergi. I'm not sure how to say his name.
Yeah, Coudenhove Kalergi. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. At some trial and in some book, he declared that the future man is going to be a Eurasian Negroid mixture. And that is going to be a citizen of the world. There will no longer be any cultural, linguistic, or nationalistic, or even genetic identity, or somehow persona, I guess you'd call it, that this person aspires to and attaches to. They are merely going to be in this sea of gray, citizen of the world. That is what the elites want, especially the British elites, because most of them, if not all of them, are high degree Masons, and they absolutely embrace that ideology. And the Nazis really nailed that whole Masonic agenda. And of course, the Jews are deep in Masonry. They got in there and they tweaked it to their agenda and to their benefit. You know, they had infiltrated it later on, but it's in a book called World Freemasonry Unveiled. It's a little pamphlet that was put out by one part of the NSDAP, one portion of the bureaucracy. And I've translated that. It's a short little pamphlet, but I mean, the Nazis busted open their archives and they literally made a museum out of the Erfurt Lodge. And they said, okay, public, come in and you see for yourself what these people have been doing behind closed doors, locked doors, shuttered windows, etc., against our nation and against the world. Here it is laid out before you. And that's why the Masons will never, ever be okay with fascism. And I mean, there are differences between National Socialism and fascism, but Mussolini persecuted Masons with a fierceness unmatched. He was much harsher than even the Germans were. But the German public could literally go into this lodge, which was now a museum, and see everything before for their very own eyes, what was going on. And these people are weird.
And that's, of course, one of the reasons why, you know, the lodges were banned, disbanded. There was it was a war on Freemasonry, really, taking place at the time as well, which is it's a very interesting turnout how this occurred, you know. But what do you think about, you know, Freemasonry here and the connection? Of course, there's a lot of Judaic mythology within Freemasonry. I think there's been a couple of rabbis talking quite openly as well about the connection between, you know, Judaism and Freemasonry, and that they're very much, you know, tied in with each other. But I mean, for sure, anybody who has an, you know, objective view on this realize that the Freemasonic network has served as this kind of underground, you know, secret society network of people who have been at the very top echelons of different organizations around the world. And consequently, we really don't know what goes on in there. We really don't know what the discussions are around those dinner tables and in those lodge meetings and whatnot. What's your view on this in terms of the connection to Judaic mythology? And if it's kind of, I don't know, do you see it as a foreign element within Europe and Western tradition? Or how do you view Freemasonry?
Well, Masonry in its actual form was a European thing. And the Masons were the builders of the cathedrals, etc. And the reason they were secret about their technology, etc., you know, their kind of training and all this, is because they didn't want the average person to be able to do what they did. They wanted to keep that exclusive to their own guilds. So they were basically just like an elite, literal Masons, group of Masons. And somehow, when that became intellectual Freemasonry, that's where the Jewish infiltration comes in. And this little pamphlet details it very well, the whole process of how it went from a literal trade to this intellectual insanity that we have now. And
I think they call it operative Masonry, and then it went into being speculative Masonry.
Exactly. So the problem is that intellectual Freemasonry now, and especially the way it's evolved since World War II, because it was so heavily persecuted by the fascists and the National Socialists. And this is another reason why those two ideologies are persona non grata. It will never be okay to be either one of those, because those two are Freemasonry's nemesis. And they're also the nemesis of the Jewish worldview and the Jewish culture. So that's why we see such intense demonization of fascism.
I see. Very interesting. So it's something that still is continuing in this regard. But I mean, I knew about Kudenhof Kalergi there for sure. Some of his quotes coming out of his book, what was it called again? Practical Idealism. And I think he wrote some on Freemasonry as well. I mean, he was a Mason, wasn't he? Do you know?
Oh, yes. He was a high degree Mason.
Yeah.
Yep. And he was apparently put on trial at some point. I'm not sure by whom, but the Nazis talk about what he said on trial. So it's rather interesting.
How do you think it is that this, for some reason, isn't? And we have had we've talked about that many times on the program now, about various people in high positions of power and influence and other organizations such as Paideia and Barbara Spector and, you know, a lot of these people, talking about, you know, kind of the destruction of European people and homogeny, you know, sometimes in a roundabout way, sometimes very much openly in this regard. But still, there's a lot of people that don't, you know, kind of comprehend that this, despite how hidden it is, or despite how obscured it is in other, other agendas or whatnot, it's still it's a genocidal policy to actively go out and try to disrupt, you know, populations in this way. And if you look at the clauses of genocide, it fits in right there. It's just a little bit more stretched out, because people think of something that happens over a short period of time where people are flat out being murdered. But in this case, you know, people could see it when it happened to the Tibetans, for example, when Chinese, you know, flooded in there, they tried to destroy their, you know, culture in this regard. But for some reason, which is very interesting, there is a disconnect, and it's almost like, you know, Europeans and white people, they can't have their own countries and interests anymore. They can't have their organizations, or they can't look out for their own, people in the same way as other people can and actually are encouraged to do. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I think a huge part of it is that we've been so doused with Freemasonic ideology, humanitarian, egalitarian, libertarian. Their ideas are our worldview. And of course, the ideas of Freemasonry are either Jewish in origin or have been influenced. And so really, our worldview is basically like a Masonic Jewish worldview. So the only ones who can have any ethnic interests in this concept of the world are the Jews themselves. And you see literally Europe, and especially the Anglo-Saxon nations, the former Commonwealth nations, America, we are literally bleeding ourselves economically, politically, culturally, and literally. for Jews. Now, how does another race or another people get our people to do this? It's just been that nonstop since the French Revolution Enlightenment ideology. It really is our concept of everything, and we're unable to get outside of it. We cannot get outside of the enlightened thinking and see it from the outside for what it really is, which is a weapon of Jewry and Masonry. And we're the ones fighting for it and making sure that it stays in power and encroaches on Islam and every other group of people in the world.
Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, consequently, the hatred is turned towards those who are wielding the weapon at the time. And of course, creating all these other conflicts as well. It's very disheartening seeing what's happening here and why and the way that people are not kind of seeing the full picture. How do you think we can raise the awareness about these kinds of things to regular people out there? I know that these are topics which are only those who are really interested in history and analyzing these kinds of questions from this point of view and whatnot. Is this something that should get out? Is it a kind of a numbers game, do you think, that the more people start to think about this and question it in this capacity, the better it will get? How do you view that?
It's hard to say. I think definitely just getting information out about fascism that's balanced and unbiased, about National Socialism that's, objective. Certainly that material is helping. The more you can present the case for fascism and National Socialism in a positive light against Masonry and Judaism and American Imperium, the more likely people are to go, okay, there were some good things about this. Maybe we need to take a second look and pull some of the good features of this. Maybe they were right about Freemasonry. It preaches love and tolerance, but it's making war and crushing and killing at the same time. So we've got cognitive dissonance going on. And then I think the other thing would be, we need to bring out the negative things about Freemasonry and especially Jewish and American or Anglo-Saxon criminality, warmongering. Unfortunately, this entails kind of turning on one's own, being denounced as anti-American or, you must be a Nazi the way you're talking about America and how dare you. I mean, I actually got screamed at right in my face in a classroom while I was working on my bachelor's degree for a presentation on Hitler's Jewish soldiers by a Marine who was serving in Iraq. He had just returned from Iraq at the time. It was unbelievable how he saw me as some subversive simply for presenting an objective view of Hitler and the Jews and the military and all this stuff. And it just blew me away. But this is what we're up against. So until you can get that Marine that was screaming in my face to reconsider what he's fighting and dying for, you're not going to get anywhere, because those are the people that have to be reached. Those are the people who are willing to enlist and lay down their life for Judeo-Masonic principles, because they really do believe that Western democratic ideas and our system is superior. And it does deserve to take over the world. There's so many people today that say Islam is evil. Look at the way they treat women. They repeatedly point out the bad things about Islam, the fact that these migrants are coming into our countries. Well, who's really behind that? I doubt they want to leave Islam and come here. There's some other forces compelling them, enabling them. So again, until you can get these average people to see how they are being used in this grander Judeo-Masonic scheme, they're not going to change their minds about anything. And it's just going to continue.
Yeah. I've always said that if people, like the world as they see it today, then, they're on good ground with the elite. They're right on path of what's going on here. And I think that people have to question, where we're going, what the objectives are, and of course, who's, benefiting from that and all those kinds of things. But yeah, it's definitely a difficult nut to crack. And I don't have all the answers, far from it, in this situation and analyzing history and try to understand and look at what's happening. But I think it's a very important initial point here in trying to kind of de-scramble all the things that we've been told, because I think anybody who has their head screwed on right can realize the immense propaganda behind certain movements and whatnot, and what the reasonings behind that is. And I think it's not for the reasons we're being told. It's quite the opposite. I think anything that poses a threat to the elite system, be that, you know, the banking system, or being that something which is ideologically driven, or when you begin to expose their ideas and whatnot, you know, you'll be fiercely, you know, heavily criticized for that, even worse in some cases. And my question there has always been, what's the harm in looking at this and just asking questions about it? Why is that so bad? Why is it criminalized in certain countries to, you know, to do this? And that's a kind of a red flag for me, you know?
Right. And I mean, a real good question everyone should ask themselves who supports the war on terror is, if you do support Israel and the war on terror and keeping that in check and stopping that, then why are your leaders inviting those very same people into your country to subvert you from within and potentially blow up targets in the United States or in Britain? This is a kind of insanity that I don't think anyone's critically thinking about. If your government's really against terrorism and Islam doing these things to women, et cetera, then why are they bringing these immigrants into your very country so that women can be beaten, beheaded, have their ears cut off, and have acid thrown in their face in your very midst? It doesn't make sense.
Well, you know, it's things like, for example, that Sweden grants blanket asylum to Syrian refugees. Well, guess what? There's, you know, these, and we, yes, we can question the origins of ISIS and ISIL and all these organizations and who's really pulling the strings there. We need to do that. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that they're ideologically aligned extremist Muslims who are seeking themselves to these organizations, and whether they understand that the leadership is kind of, you know, using them for an ulterior motive doesn't really matter if you would end up in a situation where you're, you know, potentially going to be beheaded by these people, you know. So
right.
When Sweden is doing what it's doing by granting a blanket asylum to Syrian refugees, these might be, you know, forces of ISIL. This might be a way that they look to get their foothold into Northern Europe, for example. Who knows, right? All of these are possibilities that you'd mm-hmm. think in the world of, just as you said, you know, war on terror and fear the Muslims, that they would have, you know, they would think about that. No, but see, that's a huge discrepancy in their plan. That's a huge contradiction in itself, which of course suggests that there's something, you know, else going on here in this question, you know?
Absolutely. And I think, honestly, white nationalist activists should be focusing on opposing the war and any kind of wars against Islam, because the more America does and the more Israel does, the more refugees they're producing and the more likely you're going to have mass migration continue into European countries. So if they really want to undermine immigration, you've got to stop these wars that are creating that immigration. Those people don't want to leave their country any more than we do. They're being displaced. Their countries are being blown to bits like Germany was by the Allies.
Yeah, yeah.
Why wouldn't they leave? They'd be nuts. And then you have a system of basically endless welfare that says, come along, we'll take care of you at the state and taxpayers' expense.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I understand them. I understand that there's a need for that. But again, the contradiction there is, of course, that, you know, some of these countries that are accepting the immigrants are also there, you know, aiding in the bombing of them, you know. So what's happening, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a little more convoluted than I think any of us can get our head around. And so maybe the agenda isn't quite clear what they're about.
Well, this has been a very interesting discussion, Veronica. I there's certainly a lot more other aspects to everything that we've been talking about here, and we could go on for hours and hours and turn to deconstruct what's happening, and maybe at another time we can do that, do a kind of a part two and follow up and, you know, talk about some of the other factors. And of course, as I'm going to get into a little bit more in your books as well, I'll have some more notes on some of your other material at that point. But yeah, please, you know, leave us with some of the titles here again, Veronica, in terms of the books that you recommend people to pick up, and Amazon.com, of course, is the main website for that. And we'll have some of those links up. But yeah, you know, if there's any final thoughts or something you want to leave us with, or at least mention the book, so please go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I would recommend people start with Black Nazis 2, which was it's basically my original thesis, and everything is kind of centered on and based around that thereafter, all my other books. Another good one is Truth for Germany, which covers a lot of the myths in a very quick interview style. There's a lot of really great information in there about Kristallnacht, about the volunteers, ethnic minorities and foreigners in Hitler's armed forces, etc., including numbers, which are in the millions. And then, of course, there's Hitler and Himmler Uncensored, which is two previously unpublished top secret speeches of both Hitler and Himmler that have never been publicized until Wilfried Heinck and I got a hold of them. And then the werewolves series. I mean, if you just type in Werewolves of the Iron Cross, there's 7 of those books. I'm working on the next one right now, and it should be done by the end of October. This one is going to probably be around 700 pages when it's done. And it's all about the racial views of the NSDAP, what they started out with, what they progressed to, what they ended up with, as well as a lot of really good information, unknown information on how blacks were treated in the Third Reich, black view of the Nazis, and then the Nazis' view of blacks, whether there was any NS propaganda directed at, say, African Americans against American Imperium to cause trouble for the United States. All of that will be in there. And I'd say, oh, there is one more Werewolves book, Swastika and Scimitar, Brothers in Arms, and that is translated by Hans Krampe. I wrote an introduction to it, and that details basically the Islamic National Socialist Alliance and some of the Arabic volunteers that were in Hitler's armed forces, and it is based on the memoirs of Standartenführer Franz Wimmer Lamkate. He was sent to Tanganyika to work with Africans, to start a plantation there, to do subversive activities against Britain. So his memoirs are really interesting. And that's it.
All right. Well, very good. A lot of material there to dig into, of course, and a lot of things that are, you know, interesting, that are, you know, related to all these questions. And yeah, really, you know, it's very important, I feel, you know, to try to understand what happened here. And if people realize that, you know, it's just not, the events are not just beginning here and ending here. It's an unfolding, you know, timeline here that we're on, and chain of events, really. And a lot of the things that happened around the Second World War has definitely shaped our world today. And I think a lot of the problems, you know, that we see as well is something that's kind of come out of what occurred at that point. So I think it's very important. But yeah, Veronica, we'll have the links up on redicecreations.com, the website, and redicemembers.com as well, where people can click through and find the books easily from there. But thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. And thank you for talking about your work with us today.
Thank you so much, Henrik. I really appreciate it.
Well, we hope you found today's program interesting and have some new ideas to consider. And of course, something that you further want to inquire about in terms of the topics that you are interested in and want to learn more about. There is a lot of history here and a lot of wartime propaganda to wade through, of course. But we do appreciate the work of someone like Veronica that has dedicated so much time to giving us the possibility to view a more objective position on this very difficult topic and this piece of history. We'll proceed with more in just a few days. Upcoming, we have Tom Sunick, Matthew Tate, John DeNugent, also Tracy Twyman, Morris 108, and Laird Scranton. I wish you have a great weekend, and of course, we'll talk to you more here in just a few days. For now, we say thank you for listening, thank you for being a member, and please take care and stay well.